Australia in the World is a podcast produced with the support of the Australian Institute of International Affairs. The AAA wants Australians to know, understand and engage more in international affairs. All views expressed are solely those of the speakers themselves. Hello and welcome back to the Australia in the World podcast. As always, you're with Darren Lim from the ANU. Starting with today's episode, I'm going to change the format of the introduction to the podcast a little bit by talking to you directly myself about the discussion you're about to hear and why I think it's worthwhile. I'm making this change in part because today's episode is the first of a series of at least three, possibly more, that I am planning that are likely to be even longer and more theoretically motivated than usual, united around the theme of international order. You might recall in my February discussion with Richard Maud, he referred to a speech by US Secretary of State Antony Blinken last year, where Blinken said, quote, "What we're experiencing now is more than a test of the post-Cold War order, it's the end of it," end quote. Allen himself was saying something like that for quite some time. And while Australia's current leaders haven't gone quite that far, I don't believe, Prime Minister Albanese did describe, quote, "ongoing tests of the rules-based order and resurgent challenges to free societies and open economies," end quote, in his Lowy lecture last year. The concept of, or the idea of, a possible ending of an order raises lots of questions. What exactly was the old order? Why is it ending, if indeed it is, and what might come next? And so my plan for this series is to tackle these questions from a few different angles. To get started, we're going to start on a very grim topic: war, conflict, and international order. We've crossed the two-year anniversary of Russia's invasion of Ukraine, and it's been over 5 months since Hamas attacked Israel. On a personal level, these conflicts are not just horrifying and consequential, they're also exhausting. They're both a long way from Australia's shores, and the temptation to tune out is very much there. I can feel it personally, because there's only so much violence and misery that you want to engage with in your daily life. But of course, the combatants and the civilians caught up in these conflicts don't have that luxury. Moreover, these conflicts are having, and or at least potentially will have, major impacts on international order. They are important also for the leadership role the US might play in that order going forward. And so they're important for Australia. So to discuss these conflicts through that lens, I'm joined in this episode by one of the finest international relations theorists in the country and an old friend of mine from my undergraduate days at Monash University, Andrew Phillips. Andrew is an associate professor at the University of Queensland, and if you read his UQ bio, his website says, quote, "His research focuses on war, strategy, and international order, with a particular focus on great power rivalry and asymmetric violence as drivers of transformative change in world politics," end quote. So strikingly relevant to today's topic. Andrew and I recorded this episode earlier in March, and we start with an assessment of where each of these conflicts is currently at, how they might actually end, and how they are affecting the broader international order, including the leadership role that the US is playing or not playing in each of them. It's one of the longest episodes I've ever done, but I found it time very well spent, and I hope you do too. Enjoy. Andrew, my friend, welcome, and thank you for joining me today.
Thank you, Darren. As a long-term listener, it's a pleasure to be a first-time caller, so to speak, and very much pleased to be here.
Excellent. Well, let's start with Russia-Ukraine. At the two-year mark, I would summarise the war, the current state of the war, with, say, three bullet points. First, we are now very much in a slow grind. Both sides are suffering, have paid a heavy toll, both in human life and physical destruction. While technologies like drones have been important, you've also got hundreds of miles of trenches and mines and fortifications, which really do harken back to the wars fought in the first half of the 20th century. Point two, you would say probably the wind is more at Russia's back at the moment, with a recent victory in Avdiivka, which followed Ukraine's failure to make major gains in a counter-offensive in the second half of 2023. And third, the most important medium-term variable appears to be whether Ukraine can receive the necessary material support from the West, in particular weapons and ammunition, to continue to hold Russia at bay. And the focus here really is the United States, where a military assistance bill has been passed by the Senate, but has stalled in the House. And of course, we know Donald Trump appears quite hostile to continuing support for Ukraine. So with that introduction, let's bring you in here, Andrew. How would you describe or characterize the current state of the war?
Well, Darren, I have to say that I share your relatively sober assessment of things, that if we look at the course of the war, we are now obviously 2 years into it. And I think it's worthwhile keeping in mind for the context of today's fairly sobering moment that if we look to particularly late 2022, not only was it the case that Putin failed in his initial objectives in February of 2022, but that the Ukrainians really seemed to be on the front foot for a lot of the latter half of 2022. They showed not only remarkable resilience, but also showed up the significant fragility of the Russian military. Unfortunately, looking at the situation in the contemporary context, I would say that there are a number of signs that things are certainly heading in a darker direction. And obviously, I say that editorial disclosure as someone who is very much in support of the Ukrainian cause. I'd say the first level, what you are seeing is a degree of Russian military adaptation, that the Russian military has obviously been quite slandered a lot of the time as being incredibly unadaptive, or maladaptive rather, very sluggish in its ability to respond to the Ukrainians. The evidence is that they are progressively beginning to adapt and to mitigate the strengths and agility the Ukrainians demonstrated. The second concern also is that, and I'd be very keen to get your thoughts on this, Darren, but my sense is that Putin's plan from the outset, as soon as the initial operation was not a success in February 2022, as soon as he is unable to swiftly decapitate the government in Kyiv, his strategy always was one, it was a theory of victory that had victory coming through Washington and Brussels, that it was very much predicated on weakening and chipping away the resolve of the Ukrainians by undermining the credibility of those external backers. And unfortunately, I think that we're at a juncture at the moment in which we are seeing stalemate on the battlefield, gradually shifting towards some Russian tactical military advantages. But diplomatically, I think that there are early but worrying signs that Russia's strategy is beginning to be vindicated.
Yeah, that is my major observation too. I mean, my understanding is that this recent sort of tactical victory in Avdiivka is not that big a deal from the point of view of control of the battlefield and Russia's advance, certainly on the capital. And so given that there is mostly a stalemate, that the attention inevitably turns to the home front or the home fronts. We start in Ukraine, where the population is exhausted. Zelensky has just replaced his quite successful and popular military commander. Then we turn to Washington and Brussels. We've already talked about issues with US funding. The Europeans have been quite happy, I think, to fund, in a financial sense, the Ukrainian economy, but just don't have the capability to give the weapons needed unless they start exhausting their own arsenals, which I note the Danish have actually said they should start to do. Like, let's give them everything in the cupboard. There's nothing more important right now. And then, of course, there is the Russian home front, which is more of a mystery. Of course, we've seen the death, probably the murder of Alexei Navalny, the opposition leader, in recent weeks. And to the extent that Putin's strategy is weakening Western political support, it might be that the Western strategy, which includes the Ukrainian strategy, is to hope that there is some fracturing, you know, in the Russian sort of edifice, whether that means Putin himself leaves, is forced from office, or he calculates that his political survival is actually best achieved through some negotiated deal. That might be our hope as well. In that situation, I wouldn't want to bet on that being the domino that falls first, especially with the US election coming later this year. So it is interesting how, for all the analysis of the battlefield and the technology being used and tactics and adaptation, really this war now is a discussion of domestic politics.
Yeah, I would concur. I think, and it's obviously it's a fool's errand for people to try to speculate about the internal intricacies of Russian domestic politics. But being a fool, I'm quite happy to put my position out there. One of the things that Putin has been very successful at doing in really the entire time that he's been in office, either de jure or de facto, and there's that period where he was the prime minister, I believe, rather than the president, he's been very good at using the threat of external enemies, or in the case of the Chechen insurgents, internal enemies, as a means of further consolidating his power. And so the concern that I have, if you are from the outside hoping that there will be a shift in Russia's internal political alignments, I think what that overlooks is first that he's consolidated a fairly tight system around him. Or people talk about the Siloviki, the security establishment that he's built up, that are invested as much in this conflict as Mr. Putin himself is. You've got a very successful attempt to tame the oligarchs and establish a political economy in Russia that is, again, very Kremlin-centric. So the sense that I have, if you look at historical precedent, is that there really would need to be an external catalyst in the form of perhaps a catastrophic military defeat in order for there to be any possibility of a domestic political alignment in Russia. I don't see that happening in Russia. I would observe that Zelensky, I think, has demonstrated extraordinary leadership in maintaining Ukraine's commitment and unity of resolve up to this point. I think the difficulty that he faces, obviously, though, is that this war is being played out in Ukrainian territory. The Ukrainian people are feeling the hard hand of war on a daily basis. And so that obviously creates exceptional political vulnerabilities for him. I'd be keen to get your views, Darren. My sense, I don't see any immediate shift in domestic political alignment on either side. And therefore, to me, that suggests that the conflict, at least for now, is locked in a hurting stalemate.
Yes, I think that's true. And so that means I'm grappling or reaching for a useful historical analogy. And I'm wondering if you have one in mind or any kind of comparison, because the obvious one to go to first is the Soviets in Afghanistan. And they were in Afghanistan for about 10 years, if I remember correctly. And halfway through that conflict, you had a change in political leadership. Mikhail Gorbachev comes in 1985. But it isn't until 1988, if I remember correctly, that there is a sort of a peace agreement or some kind of deal in Geneva, which leads to their withdrawal. So these things take a very long time. You mentioned the possibility of some kind of catastrophic military defeat. What do you reach for when you think about historical analogies? And how then does that fit into what we as theorists might look for in terms of how the war might end? What theories of war termination might be most useful in projecting how this may conclude, whether that's in the next few months or maybe years from now?
Yeah, look, I think that's an incredibly complex question. I've been trying to wrestle with appropriate historical analogies, and the best I could come up with actually was one from an alternative history that I envisaged of a scenario in which you have Czechoslovakia in 1938 decides to defy the Allied powers and fight Nazi Germany on their own terms. And keep in mind, 1938, the Czechoslovakians still have access to the Škoda Motor Works. They have a fairly formidable conventional military force. And this war rolls into 1939 with the Allies offering honeyed words and diplomatic support, but very little else. So that's possibly a degree of moralizing on my part in terms of the closest possible historical analogy. I think in terms of the question of how this war ends, the challenge, I think, in comparing it to Afghanistan is that in the case of Afghanistan, and I think this actually really came out in the otherwise execrable Tucker Carlson interview, when Putin gave Tucker Carlson not only a significant slice of humble pie, but also a very protracted history lesson.
Yes.
Afghanistan, ironically, December 1979, the expectation is that it will be a short, sharp, special military operation and that the Russians would be able to essentially unseat the incumbent government and be back in time, if not for Christmas, because it was communism, then at least for May Day. That didn't pan out. They were willing to pour more and more blood and treasure into that. But I think the difference is that Afghanistan was always seen as much more peripheral to the Soviet sense of their own interests than the case of Ukraine. And I think the challenge when it comes to assessing how the conflict will end is that if we're looking at this, you really need to get a sense of, well, what is the balance of military power? What is the balance of interests? And what is the balance of resolve? And I think that the war illustrated in its early months that the balance of power couldn't be extrapolated simply from looking at the respective orders of battle. The Ukrainians demonstrated very significant military agility in a way that unpleasantly surprised Putin. I would nevertheless say that Russia obviously has the advantage not simply of mass, but also of a very high degree of casualty insensitivity. The second element in terms of the balance of interests, there's an existential struggle for Ukraine. So it would be very difficult to push them towards a negotiating table. At the same time, Putin has been pretty public in investing all of his prestige into this. So as you'd know, we talk about audience costs in international relations all the time. The prospect of Putin settling for anything less than a sellable victory, I think, is relatively low. So that would then bring us to a third possibility, which would be looking at, okay, is it possible for there to be a peace that is secured or guaranteed by external parties? And I'm happy to speak to that, but for a variety of reasons, I also think that that is unlikely. What are your thoughts on that, Darren?
Yeah, the problem here is a mismatch between the objectives of the two sides. You know, we go back 12 months to the Munich Security Conference of 2023, and I remember discussing this with Alan on the podcast. You had the Ukrainian foreign minister who was insisting on a full, you know, restoration of Ukrainian sovereignty, which we take to it. And I haven't seen Zelensky or anyone really walk that back in the 12 months since, despite, you know, not achieving much success on the battlefield. And as you say, you know, if Putin is able to maintain a solid home front, then he is only going to deal if he can sell that as a victory for the special military operation that he initiated. And so the two sides, you know, you just, they can't divide the pie up. Normally we think of, as political scientists looking at this dispassionately, think of war as helping resolve these inconsistent aims. Like the battlefield reveals who has the power, and that then feeds into a negotiated settlement. But we don't have that resolution yet. And then we have the second problem, that even if we did, how do we enforce that agreement? In particular, even if there was a deal where Russia keeps Crimea and a large segment of the Donbass, and you can convince the Ukrainians to accept that, what's to stop Russia, you know, from, you know, rebuilding its strength and invading in, you know, X years' time? And this brings in your point, Andrew, about the role of external powers. You know, perhaps it is true that you know, given that credibility problem, a deal is going to have to involve some kind of security guarantee for Ukraine to accept. But that, of course, then creates an additional complication because the Russians are going to be very, very reluctant to, you know, for example, for Ukraine to join NATO, even if that was politically acceptable on the NATO side. So it's grim. Any further thoughts on that angle?
I think you've really captured something nicely there, Darren, which is that as political scientists, we all too often try to make sense of war almost as a game of bargaining. There's a famous article by Fearon that I have a distant memory of from graduate school, Rationalist Explanations for War, essentially says, well, you know, wars happen because the actors on both sides have private information about their own interests and capabilities, and then war reveals very quickly the problems that information deficit creates, that you underestimate the opponent's resolve, their capabilities, that is demonstrated on the battlefield, and then we come to the negotiating table. Now, to me, that has always been a very parsimonious way of thinking about war, but I think it's both bloodless at a broad level, but I think secondly, in this particular context, one of the difficulties of applying the bargaining theory of war, to me, that seems to work very well if you're talking about the cabinet wars of 18th century Europe, where you are essentially parceling territory back and forth between feuding dynasties, and there is very little in the way of popular involvement or investment. The second element, though, which I think makes it particularly problematic, is that Zelensky and the Ukrainians see this conflict as genuinely existential, in part because they take Putin seriously. Putin has been very consistent in saying the collapse of the Soviet Union was the greatest geopolitical catastrophe of the 20th century. He has been consistent in describing or decrying Ukraine as a fake nation. Now, I think if you're looking at a potential post-war settlement, it's very difficult to envisage how Ukraine could possibly have faith in external security guarantees. If you have Putin remaining in power, Putin remaining still very much of the view that Ukraine is a fake state, and also having the advantage of being able to learn the lessons from this conflict and strengthen and fortify his military even more. So I think on that front, it's very difficult. And we can get into also, I think, in fact, it would be worth getting into the fact that Ukraine has been the dubious beneficiary of external security guarantees before that have panned out very poorly for them.
I'm hazy on those details. So what are you referring?
So if we take a quick digression back into history, as I often want to do, Soviet Union collapses in 1991, and you've got Ukraine, the Russian Federation, and Kazakhstan that are the joint custodians of the Soviet nuclear stockpile. And of course, 1994, there's the Budapest Memorandum in which Ukraine surrenders that capability in exchange for security guarantees from the West. So I think it's a salutary tale of what happens, what are the dangers of engaging in nuclear abstinence in exchange for paper security guarantees. But we can go to more recent history. The Minsk protocols, following the 2014-2015 conflict, similarly sought to provide a degree of security for Ukraine and similarly proved profoundly wanting when it came to February 2022. Mm. So if you're the government in Kyiv, you've been let down by the West twice, it's very difficult to envisage a peace settlement that would possibly allay those concerns in a meaningful fashion.
Let's zoom out then to the impact of this conflict on regional and global order. How do you see this war affecting the trajectory of the current order? And do you see this more as a newly rising Russia looking to transform an order or a declining power seeking to reassert itself one last time?
I think it's undeniable that Russia is in relative decline. If we look at, and one of the benchmarks that I always use for this is if we think about the foundations of national power, the Russian Federation has a vastly greater population than that of Australia, and yet the economies are relatively the same in terms of size. Now, that's not to reduce everything to economic power, but it is to say if we look at the 1980s, which I vaguely remember from my precocious childhood looking at films like Red Dawn, the Soviet Union was one of the two superpowers.
Yes.
These days, you'd have to say it's a super spoiler, that it's capable of creating a significant degree of disruption in the international system, but no more in the game of trying to create an alternative contemporary order. The second thing that I would say, and why I have been very much focusing myself on this conflict in the past couple of years, I think it is decisive for the future of international order. What we have at stake here is an essential question, which is it permissible in the international system for one state to be able to kill or at least significantly territorially mutilate another? And the guarantees that we've had against that danger that have worked remarkably well since 1945, by the way, these states have died as a result of conquest. I can think of South Vietnam, not too many others beyond that. Mm. From a realist perspective, security guarantees and alliances. From a liberal perspective, collective security institutions like the UN. From a constructivist perspective, you've had norms against conquest. All of those firewalls against a return to the 1930s seem to be buckling at this point in time.
I guess I've been thinking about it slightly differently, and my kind of answer focuses around your description of Russia as a super spoiler. I agree that Russia's power is declining, and so to me it seems extremely unlikely that they have the capability to keep going beyond Ukraine. I mean, I know Poland and the Baltic states are nervous and justifiably so given things that Putin himself has said. But to me, they are part of NATO, and I don't expect a Russian invasion of those is likely anytime within a generation. And so To me, the threat to the order is less focused on the norm of aggression and the extinction of a state. And sidebar on this, of course, a global South critique is that we may be witnessing the destruction of something like a state in Gaza right now, and we'll come to that later in the podcast. But more that the last grasp of Russian power is sapping the energy of the defenders of the order, being the United States and Europe. Real, legitimate, and immediate security problems reduce their ability to defend the order elsewhere, to promote it elsewhere, and in many ways sort of reveal the hypocrisy Global South accuses them of vis-a-vis Israel and Gaza. I guess maybe in some ways we're arguing the same point from different directions, sort of saying, well, this is a norm that once it gets violated, really it could be a slippery slope. And I'm saying, well, there's no one to defend the order because they're so caught up with the problems that Russia is posing. Do you see them as a sort of equivalent, or what's your response to my point?
Yeah, I think it's a really terrific intervention because it does dramatize the question of what do we mean by this question-begging phrase, international order? And I use my view on it, and I'm not offering much in the way of optimism, Darren, so I do apologize for that, but it's some time that we live in, despite the sunny weather that I'm enjoying in southeastern Queensland. One way of approaching international order, I think, is along the lines that you were discussing, of saying this is a construct that developed in particular under US leadership post-1945. It has a North Atlantic core with some Antipodean offshoots. And what we're witnessing at the moment is the corrosion of resolve and unity within that core. I agree with you. I think that that is happening, and I think that is noticeable not simply in domestic political polarization and the rise of populism in both Europe and the United States, but also I think at the material level, the fact that you've got the United States in the 1940s, even prior to entering into the Second World War, was the arsenal of democracy. The fact that we have essentially outsourced Western manufacturing and as part of the process of globalization, I think really undercuts the material basis of that. But for me, the question is more ambivalent about that liberal international order. Even if you accept the valid and powerful critiques of members of the Global South that highlight the hypocrisy, the illusions, the contradictions of that order. If we look at the ASEAN summit that has just occurred, we again hear the diplomatic boilerplate of the rules-based global order, which to me is like the Rorschach inkblot of diplomatic statements. It can mean anything that you want it to mean. But for me, for it to have any substance at all, it would seem to need to rest on the foundation that sovereign states should not be allowed to kill each other or rip chunks of territory off each other through force. So I think regardless of the lens in which you look at it through, whether a thick or a thin conception of international order, I think very much this, the Ukraine conflict is demonstrating the fragility and ongoing fragmentation of that order.
Well, let's bring US leadership in at this point. And I went back and reviewed the discussion that Alan and I had at the one-year anniversary of the conflict 12 months ago. And Alan said, quote, "The war has strengthened the United States and its leadership after the uncertainty of the Trump and the Biden administration's mishandling of the war in Afghanistan. Contrary to expectations, especially Putin's, Washington has held NATO together, opened the prospect for its expansion, exercised very effective diplomacy, and the most creative use of intelligence for statecraft I have seen," end quote. And of course, he was referring to the warnings that Washington was giving that believed by most of Europe, as I recall, that an invasion was imminent in February of 2022. Now, 12 months have passed. I very much wish that Alan were here to update that assessment. We're going to have to do it in his absence, sadly. How do you see US leadership now, 2 years in? How important is that answer to the broader question of the trajectory of the order that we've just been discussing?
I am deeply apprehensive about the future of US leadership in the international system. And I really proceed from the conviction that certainly for Australia, that US-sponsored post-1945 order worked quite well. And again, reasonable minds might differ on that, and there are certainly legitimate dissenting views on that position. One of the things, though, that I think has been problematic is that if you look at that period of, I guess if we look at it in retrospect, the golden era of US hegemonic leadership during dark decades of the Cold War, when the outcome of that conflict was by no means certain, there was a fairly broad political consensus in the core of Democrats and Republicans in the validity and utility of maintaining an extroverted US strategic posture. And I think what we're observing at the moment is that we are beginning to see a progressive unraveling of that domestic political consensus. And there are a variety of different and interesting reasons behind that. I think part of it is a loss of generational memory. If we think about it, look at the entire history of the US Republic, it was a deviation from past practice to have permanent alliances post-1945. And I think the horrors of inaction in the 1930s were extremely powerful as a means of reinforcing that policy consensus. So I see that whittling away at the moment. And there are only just two other things that I'd like to say. The first is that, as we know, perception is everything in politics. The United States remains an extraordinarily powerful, indeed preeminent actor at a material level. The economy is going gangbusters while its rival China is in a state of economic stagnation. It remains extraordinarily potent as a full-spectrum military superpower. But I think the perception that United States resolve is faltering is beginning to percolate throughout the international system. The second point I'd say, and this is where I do have sympathy for Americans who have raised concerns about America's ongoing engagement in the international system, I think there's plenty of blame to go around. If we look at the international system, particularly in response to the crisis in Europe, it is telling that Germany has repeatedly said that they are committed to the idea of a complete shift in their strategic posture, and yet they've consistently been laggards on that front. So I think the problems of leadership are real. They are rooted in shifts in America's domestic political configurations, but I think that they are also amplified by certain, for want of a better phrase, deadbeat allies who have been used to the idea of relying on the United States for too long.
Yeah, I would start my response to that with the glass half full analysis, which really echoes what Alan said a year ago. The US was very much there in that first 12 months. Ukraine was able to the surprise of almost everyone, mount a successful defense. And the US was there both in the lead up and in the first 12 months to provide the material support and the political support to sustain and lock in that initial defense and hopefully hamstring the Russian state for a generation, regardless of its ability to keep fighting right now. And so that is a success. And I think Alan was correct back then that the US leadership had been demonstrated to do what was required, given the constraints that Russia is a nuclear power. It's not like they could extinguish the conflict, you know, resolve it immediately. But what we've seen in the next 12 months is that the challenge has morphed into one of needing to offer sustained support and hold a degree of political unity amongst the US public and its allies that, as you point to, is just no longer possible given sort of the fracturing nature of democratic political systems and the populist world, populist moment or era that we are in. US leadership is not faltering because of material weakness. As you say, materially, the US is still very strong, but the nature of US politics has changed. I come back to this book by Martin Gurry, The Revolt of the Public, which really highlights how the general public is much more against things than they ever were before. They have access to much broader avenues of information that allow them to amplify grievance. And so elites who used to run foreign policy with very little interference from the common person are now increasingly constrained in what they can do. But unfortunately, that is what this moment requires. And so the inability of the US to do that is leading, or at least we can see the dark clouds on the horizon, possibly a big change, you know, ultimately on the battlefield in Ukraine. So it is interesting how the nature of the power required to sustain the order in that first 12 months has really changed from the past 12 months. But I unfortunately share your pessimism into the future.
I think as armchair critics and academic outsiders, it's easy for us to decry the limitations of US leadership, but it is worth also acknowledging that the United States has played a very significant role behind the scenes in preventing a further escalation of the conflict. Now, that is something that is never going to be particularly visible to the public. It is reliant upon instruments of statecraft that often work best when they are not publicly visible. But I think that that is worth acknowledging. But the point that I'd like to close on is that hegemony is a choice. If you are deciding to be a hegemonic actor in the system, if you are making a claim to leadership, the hegemon can always go home. And I think that's the enduring appeal of America First, is that you can say, well, we'll retain our material power, but we'll be unencumbered of these other obligations. To make the case for hegemony is to do precisely that, is to engage in continuous public mobilization of support. It's hard to do when you have feckless allies, and it's even harder to do in the current conditions of polarization that you discussed earlier.
Let's move on to an even more grim topic, which is Gaza and the awful, awful situation there. Let me try to summarize the current state of play again with the following four bullet points. First, Israel's counter-offensive continues, with the latest numbers from the Gaza Ministry of Health putting the death toll at more than 30,000, over 10,000 of whom were children, and another 70,000 people injured. The humanitarian crisis continues to worsen, with reports that children are starving to death. Second, we are also learning more about the atrocities from the October 7 attack and the fate of the hostages currently being held, with the United Nations finding, quote, clear and convincing, end quote, evidence that rape and sexual violence was used on the October 7 attacks, and that the hostages currently being held have been raped and tortured. Third, there have been ongoing discussions for weeks about a potential ceasefire, possibly as soon as this weekend, to coincide with the beginning of Ramadan. And I'd note that this podcast will come out after that, so we don't know yet the outcome of that situation. And fourth and finally, the weight of international opinion, from my perspective, continues to build against Israel. And you can even see cracks now in US support, with Vice President Harris calling this past week for a ceasefire, and reports that the US has finally circulated its own text in the UN Security Council calling for a ceasefire. This is after having vetoed multiple resolutions in recent weeks. So with that summary, I wanted to sort of start with the fact that you also study terrorism in addition to studying interstate conflict. For you, what is the most useful model for understanding what's happening here? Is this an interstate war? Is it a case of terrorism and counterterrorism, or perhaps insurgency and counterinsurgency? And does the answer to this question matter?
Excellent question, Darren, and I've tried to give this some thought in terms of what categories that it would fall into in terms of how we think about this as international relations theorists. I think this is a protracted, internationalized conflict between a state and a quasi-state. To break that down, this is the latest iteration of a conflict that dates at least back to the 1940s, but has its antecedents in the communal conflicts in the British-Palestinian Mandate back in the interwar period. It's an internationalized conflict in that what we see is both Israel's continuing reliance on the support, both diplomatic but also material, of its primary patron, the United States. But you also have very clearly in the actions of Hamas an effort to coordinate its actions with both Iran and also the so-called axis of resistance of Iran's non-state affiliates across the region. And the third element, obviously, is that it's an asymmetric conflict between Israel, a sovereign state, although one that obviously does not enjoy universal recognition, and the possible stem of a Palestinian state. I mean, further complicated by you've got the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank and Hamas as a difficult to characterize terrorist statelet in Gaza. So I think when it comes to trying to approach the conflict, one of the most difficult challenges is trying to untangle the fact that you've got the core Israel-Palestinian antagonism, that is in turn connected to a larger internationalized conflict in the Middle East, which necessarily then draws in actors from outside the region as well. And I think if we're trying to anticipate what a possible peaceful resolution would look like, it actually does involve a need to have an analytical lens that encompasses those three different dimensions.
Well, that begs the question of how you do that, because I do think, like you, the answer matters. You know, we've just been discussing theories of war termination in what is more a traditional interstate conflict. But those theories and the variables that matter, the conditions that matter for a resolution, are very different to those that would see the resolution of a counterterrorism operation or a counterinsurgency operation. So I invite you now to try to kind of weave in the different strands of these models into sort of an answer of how you think this conflict can unfold and actually resolve itself.
Well, I think, again, if we're kind of drilling into those different levels, the core antagonism between the Israelis and the Palestinians, the great challenge there, obviously, is that at the moment we have a deep disconnect between what has been, up until the last few years, a broad international consensus around the desirability of a two-state solution, and the fact that we have actors on both sides now that favour maximalist one-state solution options. Now, Hamas is explicit about that. It's very clear in their charter that they talk about the idea of the need to eliminate the Zionist entity, and their actions and their rhetoric, both October 7 and beyond, indicate that they are very much committed to that mission even now. I think the challenge, though, is that if you look at the Netanyahu government's posture, it's equally seems to be inclined towards a more maximalist kind of solution. And I think while you've got, again, there are analogies that when we're looking at Ukraine's situation, there's a certain degree of intractability in the fact that you have the political coalitions dominant on both sides at the moment, both favour a maximalist solution that eliminates the other side.
The way I've been thinking about this is to go back to the war aim that has been explicitly articulated by Netanyahu, which is total victory over Hamas. If Hamas is a state, total victory means a very different prospect than if it is a terrorist organization or an insurgency. Because the problem is that if it's a state, then it has political constituencies, and the state will respond to incentives based upon how its population is affected and how its population can put pressure on it as a governing entity to come up with some solution. And here with Hamas, yes, it has some state-like characteristics, like it has been performing some functions of governance, and it has obviously an armed wing, but it's also a set of ideas, right? This is the insurgency part, right? That the idea of resisting a foreign force occupying the homeland from the Palestinian perspective. And so what does it mean to achieve total victory over that? I don't think you can extinguish that idea. And in many ways, we can get into this, Israel's counteroffensive has actually strengthened that idea, which to me means that the concept of a total victory over Hamas seems impossible. But you can't really, I can't make that claim without sort of understanding it. Hamas is not as much of a state here, but an idea and an insurgency. Would you agree with that?
I would agree, Darren. And I think as we're both aware as students of international conflict, war aims are dynamic over time. They very much respond to the changing fortunes both on the battlefield and at the negotiating table. So I can certainly see in the aftermath of what was really a deliberately provocative and outrageous attack on October 7. I mean, Al-Aqsa flood was of a level of complexity that was clearly planned well in advance, but in which there are credible and systematic reports of the sustained use of gender-based violence as a means of provoking Israel into a disproportionate retaliation. So the political salability of an objective other than destroying Hamas or achieving total victory over it, it would be difficult to have seen how that could have been articulated in the immediate aftermath of those atrocities. So speak to your issue, though. I think the challenge is that it all depends on what you mean by a total victory over Hamas. Do you mean the elimination of the leadership? So essentially leadership decapitation and the installation of a more pliant leadership, Well, that doesn't appear to be what the objectives are on the part of Israel at the moment. And understandably so, you would need all sorts of security assurances that the people that were going to be in power would be able to be sufficiently distinct from their predecessors. If it means the destruction of Hamas as a political organisation, and I think there's no great insight in offering this, but we often say in asymmetric conflicts, if you're losing, you're not being outgunned, you're being outgoverned. I think the challenge is that Hamas has had now 2 decades of governance responsibility in the Gaza Strip. So the challenge that you're facing is that on the one hand, Israel doesn't have the diplomatic bandwidth to pursue a policy of direct annexation or indefinite occupation. But total victory of Hamas to the extent that it is eliminated from governance in Gaza then begs the question, if not Hamas, then who? And I think that that's where there is a real challenge in terms of trying to conceptualize what that victory would necessarily look like.
And I don't just pin this on the Israeli government. One of the mantras that you heard in the aftermath of October 7 was that there was a need to restore deterrence. And deterrence is a concept that is normally associated with interstate conflict. And I've harped on this before on the podcast. There is a big difference between deterrence by punishment and deterrence by denial. Israel's counteroffensive is very much in the category of deterrence by punishment. And logic here is, if you attack us, we are going to respond, overreact with such disproportionate force and inflict so much misery on you that you and anyone else who is watching will never think about crossing us into the future. And that has been a pretty successful strategy. I mean, I've had one diplomat describe it to me as the craziest guy in the room, that Israel for many decades now has deliberately sort of adopted this posture, messaging to the region, right? Don't mess with us because we will lose our minds, right, in response. And you know, yes, there have been conflicts with Hezbollah, but by and large, the states in the region have seen this and they've understood it, and it has been relatively successful. But that sort of assumes that you're dealing with states that have a normal political relationship between the leadership and the governed. And Hamas is not like that, right? And this is where it becomes closer to a terrorist organization or an insurgency, where there is a very different calculus. As you say, how do you deter an organization that is trying to provoke you, right? In many ways, has achieved its primary strategic objective in provoking this counter-reaction, which is putting the Palestinian issue back on the world stage, probably alienating an entire generation of leaders and elites, not just in the West, but in the global South, against Israel, given the ferociousness of the retaliation. And so it seems like that Israel has given Hamas exactly what they wanted, and therefore deterrence by punishment has failed. In contrast, the deterrence by denial idea is simply that you are looking to deny your adversary the ability to hurt you, right, to attack you. This is done first in your own defensive fortifications, and it strikes me that a few, you know, more troops on the border, a stronger fence, better intelligence, as we've seen reports coming out, might have been enough to prevent this and could be enough to prevent Hamas doing something similar in the future. But also, of course, there is going to be an element of decapitating Hamas's leadership, right? And killing, attacking leaders can be a very important part of a counter-terrorism strategy, as we saw under the Obama administration in its dealings in Afghanistan. But the important thing is that you can achieve the same objective of security, right, through different means. And it just strikes me that you're never going to get 100% security. And the attempt to achieve that through deterrence by punishment actually might be making Israel less secure. In fact, I'm pretty confident it is making Israel less secure. How do you read all that?
Yeah, I'm mindful of a conversation that we've had earlier in our time at the War College of thinking about this through the lens of grand strategy. And your observation, the idea that grand strategy is ultimately a theory of security. And I think for me, trying to make sense of the deterrence equation is inseparable from understanding, okay, well how did we get here? And for me, I think it is relevant in terms of the overall context, what the Netanyahu government's strategy was prior to October 7. And to me, it seemed to be very much a strategy of incremental settler expansion in the West Bank, but undergirded by a sustained diplomatic attempt to de-link the Israeli-Palestinian conflict from the larger regional security conflict. So the Abraham Accords, the attempt to normalize diplomatic relations with Saudi Arabia that seemed to be gaining some momentum prior to October 7. But as a concomitant to that, a very explicit strategy of dealing with the Palestinians and Hamas in particular through what would mowing the lawn, the idea of saying, look, we don't need to actually politically resolve this as a conflict. All we need to do is to engage in continuous low-level use of military coercion to eliminate the threat. And my sense is that that was the grand strategy of the Netanyahu government. And the core strategic motivation of Al-Aqsa flood was Hamas's attempt to upend that strategy. I often think about, in looking at the atrocities that were associated with October 7, you're completely right. That was deliberately intended to goad Israel into a disproportionate response. And I think if we're trying to approach this through the question of deterrence, a prior question is, well, what was Hamas's theory of victory in October 7? They knew they were going to provoke a huge retaliation. They knew also they didn't simply price in large-scale civilian casualties, but they actually depended on those civilian casualties to further draw other actors into the region. In my view, the theory of victory was to induce an Israeli disproportionate response as a catalyst for drawing in a larger range of actors, Hezbollah and ultimately Iran, as a means of eliminating Israel. Now, when it comes to the question of deterrence, how do you seek to deter an actor that is utterly hell-bent on your own destruction? I think the challenge here is that Israel's reputation for deterrence has actually been harnessed to Hamas's advantage. I think if it comes to the question then of, okay, well, what deterrence model would work? I think the difficulty with that is it's hard to deter an actor over whom you seek to secure decisive and complete victory. So the question then for Israel would be, who besides Hamas are you trying to deter? Now, is the deterrence message aimed more broadly at the Palestinian people? Is it aimed at Iran and other actors in the region? And I think that's one of the questions that needs to be considered when we think about what possible logic of deterrence should work here, keeping in mind that deterrence is but one pathway to engaging and or acquiring long-term security.
Well, let's stick with that then. What models or analogies do you reach for in thinking about how this conflict might come to an end?
Again, I am pessimistic simply because of the maximalist objectives of both sides. I don't see any moderation in Hamas's posture. I find it notable that despite the broad international consensus that is developing in favor of a ceasefire, that Hamas has been continually reticent to embrace that as an option. Now, they have taken extraordinary casualties. They have seen even greater casualties inflicted on the long-suffering Palestinian people, but they clearly are still operating under a strategic calculus where a further protraction of the conflict they see as being to their advantage. The difficulty from the Israeli side, and there's no sugarcoating this, Netanyahu's political survival now depends on continuing support from the far right, including settlers in the West Bank that have now been unprecedentedly sanctioned by the Biden administration. While you have a situation in which the government in Israel is unable to plausibly deny an aspiration to engage in further territorial annexation, I see there's been no prospect for peace on that front. And likewise, while Hamas remains entrenched within Gaza, I don't see the possibility of accommodation there, which is really at some level a council of despair of saying that what we actually need at this point is a political realignment on both sides for a bargaining window to become possible. Be keen to get your views on that though, Darren.
No, I think that's correct. I don't think in the absence of political change on either side, you can even go to the bargaining table. So I think you've outlined that very well. But then let's live in a sort of temporary fantasy land for a moment and imagine that such political change is possible, that, you know, that Netanyahu does leave office, perhaps is replaced by a somewhat more moderate leader like Benny Gantz, who, you know, has just been in the United States over Netanyahu's objections, I understand, actually, and that someone can be found inside the Palestinian political system that the Israelis are willing to work with and who can and has the credibility and the potential for support of the Palestinian people. Where, how do you then see what a durable medium to long-term political solution might look like? How do we provide security for both Israelis and Palestinians?
I'm of the view, and I lay no claims to being an expert on Middle Eastern politics, so I'll defer to listeners who have greater authority and experience in that area. But I'm of the view with protracted decades-long asymmetric conflict, I always look to examples elsewhere of how we've been able to secure peace. And the analogy is very, very far from perfect, but I look at the conflict in Northern Ireland. And Northern Ireland, similarly in certain respects, a settler colonial conflict or can be categorised to a certain degree in some of those terms. And we saw a peace resolution occur there under two conditions. The first was that both actors needed to reach a hurting stalemate. That is, a situation in which they could not plausibly see how they could further advance their goals through resort to force. And you also needed a credible international mediator. In that context, it was the Clinton administration that helped to broker the Good Friday Accords. The third element, though, is that if we look at the broad contours of the Good Friday Accords in terms of power sharing and what that model looked like, it was remarkably similar in detail to the Sunningdale Accords that were proposed in the early 1970s, so only a few years after the conflict initially started, that ultimately resolved it. To the extent, you know, people talk about the Good Friday Agreement as being Sunningdale for slow learners. So the message that I take out of this is one that is really thinking, if we look at the brass tacks of what a peace settlement would look like, we've been having this conversation since 1967, at least. It seems to be the idea of a two-state model. The Palestinian people, despite the wishes of people like Netanyahu, they are not going to go away. That national identity has been forged in the furnace of over eight decades of conflict. And likewise, Israel, one of the most potent conventional militaries in the world, an undeclared nuclear power, Israel is not going to go away either. So if we're looking at what could potentially create a peace, I think that the contours of those peace agreements can be taken back as far as at least the Oslo Accords of the early 1990s. What you would need ultimately would be the emergence of both a hurting stalemate and an internationally plausible mediator and guarantor, which unfortunately, again, leads us back to the perennial question of US leadership.
I was just going to add that sort of to adapt that phrase, I believe, attributed to Churchill, that a two-state solution is the worst except for all the other ones. And I think what's interesting about that, if we were to characterize this as a counterinsurgency or an insurgency and a counterinsurgency, the US has always had the benefit that it could just withdraw because it was fighting these insurgencies a long way from home. But here you have two sides that are right next to each other and really on top of each other. And as you said earlier, it seems impossible that there is a model where Israel is able to provide security and monopolize the use of force in Palestinian territories in ways that are politically acceptable. I just think it would go on forever and it would be impossible. And so all that is left is a two-state solution, notwithstanding the immense political hurdles that get there. But this sort of idea that you raise of both sides being exhausted, right, and realizing that at some point the continued use of force is not going to advance their objectives seems to me to be the theoretically correct one. But gosh, it is grim because that could take a very, very long time to arise and cause a lot of misery in the meantime. But let's then bring the US in like we did with the Ukraine situation. In my understanding, again, I am far from an expert on these issues, is that if we look at the history of Israeli military operations, it has traditionally been the US at various points that said, okay, and you are not allowed, we will not permit you to continue. And I know these debates are happening right now over the possible sort of next phase of the conflict on Rafah, which has, I think, 1.5 million Palestinians internally displaced people there right now, and the Israelis want to make a military move on it. And recent reporting from the past few days has said that the US is saying, well, you need a plan for what to do with these 1.5 million people before we would green light this. So it suggests that there is, despite the hostility or the ignoring of Netanyahu towards US pressure, that there is still a meaningful role the US can play. At the same time, it is taking immense reputational damage within, you know, certain parts of the US polity, but especially around the world, for not doing more to protect the plight of Palestinians. So how do you see US leadership here, and what's possible and what dynamics are most important?
I think one of the questions that we need to ask is, in order to exert effective leadership in the region, what are the levers of influence that the United States can possibly exercise? But also, what is its level of sustained strategic interest in the conflict? Keeping in mind that the hegemon can always go home, there's always the possibility of the United States pivoting elsewhere. So I think on the first question, I look at where has the United States been effective in intervening as a peacemaker in the Middle East in the past? And I'd say if we look at the Camp David Accords, that's an interesting instance in which the United States was able to offer Egypt significant territorial concessions in terms of the territories being returned by Israel that were won during the Six-Day War. It was also willing and able to become a patron of Egypt during that time. We fast forward to 1994 and the peace settlement between the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan and Israel. And again, the United States playing a very significant role in providing material largesse to support a key strategic ally in the region. The challenge, as I see it, is that for the United States to exercise effective influence, it needs both credibility, the broad recognition that it is engaging in a manner that is relatively even-handed, which is difficult given the United States' historic commitment to Israel. But second, in order to be able to exert meaningful strategic influence, you need to be able to both give the parties something that they would not otherwise possess, and that's the Israelis and the Palestinians. But you also need is a United States that is remains sufficiently engaged and interested to care about the conflict. And I think one of the things that has been a significant surprise to me, if we look at the last 12 months even of the United States engagement in the region, in 73-74, the US was invested in the Yom Kippur conflict, not simply to assure Israel's survival, but also the second order consequences of the oil shocks forcing the United States to strategically invest in the region. If we fast forward to the present, the United States does not depend on Middle Eastern oil in the same way. But I think the second thing that has been drawing the United States to the region is that, again, this comes to the question of domestic political consensus. From at least the Six-Day War onwards, there has been a very significant, broad United States cross-partisan political consensus in favour of unstinting support of Israel. We now see the investment in Israel beginning to chip away at the edges of elements of the progressive wing of the Democrats. And I think once you have those ties of sentiment becoming more complex, and once you have the United States' strategic interest in the region potentially being called into greater question, then I think that you've got a twofold challenge. The United States doesn't necessarily have the leverage to exercise leadership, and it's increasingly questionable whether or not it has the enduring interest to do so.
And if it wasn't grim enough, then let's zoom out and think about the implications of that, if correct, for the trajectory of international order. In our discussion on Russia-Ukraine, you made the point about the norm of aggression and that states shouldn't be able to kill each other. I made the point about tying up resources in the European continent that might be used to defend the order elsewhere. If the US is unable to play a decisive role here, what's the collateral damage that might do to the broader international order, whether in the region or globally?
So I'm going to, if you'll indulge me, Darren, I'm going to draw upon my expertise, supposedly, in international relations theory, because I have had an enduring career-long interest in the question of international order. And I think that theoretical lenses give us varying degrees of hope and despair if we're approaching this. The first thing I'd do is politely contest the premise that US hegemony is necessarily in irretrievable and irreversible decline. As a natural pessimist, I am inclined to accept that characterization, but I think it's salutary to keep in mind that the United States is extraordinarily resilient. It remains materially extraordinarily powerful. But we've also seen this film before. If we look at the 1970s, you know, post-Watergate, post the United States humiliation in Vietnam, the period of stagflation, a period in which even the United States President, President Carter, talked about a moment of national malaise. That was a situation in which we saw a significant degree of conflict in the international system and a widespread element of despair in the United States' willingness and capacity to engage in international leadership. The 1% optimist in me suggests that there might be the prospect of the United States regenerating once again. Never bet against America is my view on that. But, and here is the pessimist in me, which will be probably the remainder of my observations here. So we'll be relying on you, Darren, to actually bring out a degree of hope and sunshine to round out the discussion. The question is, first, whether America wants to retain hegemonic leadership. And we've canvassed this already. I think the political consensus there is fragile. The generational memory that sustained popular support for an extroverted US strategic posture is increasingly eroding through the remorseless logic of demography. The question finally, though, for the United States' capacity to also engage in that hegemonic leadership role. We are in a world now that Amitav Acharya and others have described as a multiplex world, one in which you've got a range of other order builders. So I think realistically, barring the possibility of the United States hegemony magically reconstituting once again, we're really at a crossroad in which on the one side, you've got a more distributed series of international orders, probably cohering at a regional level in which you've got positive end of the spectrum, one in which you've got a balance of power favouring liberal democracy in various parts of the world. At another end of the spectrum, a much more diverse set of regional orders. If you can imagine an Atlantic order, if you can imagine a Eurasian order potentially centred around the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, kind of as you have described in an excellent article with John Eikenbury, an illiberal hegemony developing in some parts of the world. That's one possibility. The other possibility is a vision of Kaplan's claim way back in the 1990s that we're facing a coming anarchy in which the order disappears. We're in a sort of a 1930s moment in which the United States recedes and other powers are unwilling or unable to step up to the challenges of global governance. So I think those are the three pathways that I see ahead of me: an unlikely reconstitution of US hegemony, a more multiplex set of orders, or a coming chaotic disorder. I'd be keen to get your sense, Darren, of have I exhausted the possibilities? I've probably exhausted your listeners, but have I exhausted the possibilities?
No, I think that is a very comprehensive description of the options. And I think my sense is that we'll get all three in that will ebb and flow in the years ahead. But to me, sort of what I want to extract from that, and perhaps this is actually closest to the coming anarchy thesis of Kaplan, is that the cynicism that is really growing among the global South, but I think also amongst many elites in the West, at the perceived hypocrisy in how the Ukraine conflict and the Gazan conflict have been handled by the US, is really eroding the values, such as there were sort of liberal values that were consciously and explicitly and publicly embedded in the post-World War II order. That moment has gone, and that the way in which we will talk about the order in the future is going to need to be much more value neutral. We cannot proselytize, I guess is perhaps the correct verb, these liberal virtues as being liberal and therefore virtuous. The main collateral damage that emerges from that is that in the absence of someone willing to provide global public goods on a global scale, we will see violence and more unsavory methods as means of conflict resolution. And so that's sort of the anarchy element, not that the whole thing is going to become fully chaotic and anarchic in Kaplan's telling, but that it's an inevitable byproduct of the lack of a single anchor. And we, in many ways, we see this just this past week in the ASEAN conference meetings between Australia and the ASEAN leaders in Melbourne, right? The big sore, right? The festering sore is Myanmar, because the ASEAN states are both unable and in many ways unwilling to take any decisive steps to help progress that to an acceptable solution. And I made this point when I was talking with Richard Mord a month or so ago, that we're in a world where individual states have more agency to do things at home and really get away with it, because there isn't the weight of international power, whether concentrated in a hegemon or in a large coalition, in order to sort of stop them from doing that. Now, the optimistic slant, or at least the positive agenda that comes from that, stems from my continued belief, I'm sure shared by you, Andrew, that the liberal mechanisms of governance are still pretty effective ones, right? We do need rules to organize behavior, to help overcome cooperation problems. Liberal mechanisms like markets, like individual rights, like accountable and transparent governments actually do, in my view, lead to the things that people ultimately want, which is economic development, which is human flourishing, which is progress in things like medicine and science and so forth. And so what we need to do is not throw up our hands and pack up and go home, but emphasize the practical benefits of the liberal element of the order, but not characterized as being liberal, characterized as markets to deliver economic growth. Individual rights and personal freedoms help societies flourish, and make that it's very much a slog. It's a step-by-step process made individually with governments, but made continuously and committedly, rather than we have this glorious liberal framework and we just need to adhere to that. Because for all of the erosion and the weakening of the current order, we still do not have an obvious alternative, let alone one that's appealing, right? I mean, I don't think the Chinese, and that this is, you mentioned an article, Andrew, and I'm hoping to have a podcast on this in the near future with one of the authors who critiqued it. And the one point that we make in that article is the Chinese vision is no more concrete than anything that we have right now. And so it's not like there is something waiting in the wings, right? So disorder or anarchy, in a relative sense, is what we should expect a little bit more of, but that doesn't mean we lack a playbook for how to manage that. But we have to accept that we're going to have, I guess, more violence and a bit more disorder as a result. Is that optimistic?
Well, unsurprisingly, Darren, I agree emphatically with you. And I recall a quote that has been attributed, or possibly misattributed, to the great IR theorist Robert Gilpin, who was alleged to have said, "I'm a liberal living in a realist world." For me, as someone who studies international order, what we do, you can't study international order in a value-neutral fashion. And for all of its imperfections, I would agree with you absolutely in terms of the virtues of liberalism and liberal institutions. I think one of the challenges that we're going to face, and I agree with you on the point of the corrosive impact of hypocrisy on the perceived integrity of that order. A shout out to one of your ANU colleagues, George Lawson, who's written a terrific piece with Aisha Zarakol from University of Cambridge, where they argue that hypocrisy is actually especially lethal to liberal internationalism, given that it front ends these values of moral universalism. I think one of the challenges that we're going to face, and I think that it is incumbent upon us to try to cultivate the virtue of humility. My sense is that we're in the 2020s, we're finally experiencing the hangover of the great party for liberal internationalists that was the 1990s. Now, if you think of grand strategy all the way up to that point, in the 1940s, the struggle against fascism demanded an alliance with the Soviet Union. That was a bitter pill to swallow, but the Western allies did it. In the Cold War, the struggle against communism meant often unsavory, unpalatable moral alliances with authoritarian states. We did that. I think the post-1989 period created both a growth in the ambition of liberal internationalism, but also I think it led us to temporarily forget the restraints on Western power in particular, and the vulnerabilities and imperfections of that liberal vision. And I come back to this question of generational cohorts. I think we're still in the era in which the great hopes of the 1990s have not yet been entirely extinguished, but where the realities of shifting material power balances and the corrosion of some of the moral credibility of that order is going to induce a degree of humility, but not resignation or despair.
I think we'll leave it there. This has been fantastic. But on the final point of humility, but not resignation or despair. I'm reminded of my dear friend, Alan Gingell, and I would like you, if you wish, to share a memory or a reflection on him before we wrap up today.
Yeah, I had the great privilege of working with Alan as a visiting fellow. We basically were doing an academic duet at the Australian War College in the middle of the pandemic, which meant that I only ever knew Alan as a friendly face on Zoom. And my enduring impression of him throughout that week was not simply his intellectual curiosity and his expansiveness in the historical and theoretical and practical knowledge that he had at his disposal, but also his great intellectual generosity, that he was very much willing and interested and keen to engage both with the course members and also with me, which I found was both a great honour of my career, but also, I think, a great testament to some of the signature virtues that characterise Alan.
Thank you, Andrew. And for our very final segment, reading, listening and watching, do you have a recommendation for our audience?
I do have a recommendation, Dune Part 2. I found it to be aesthetically an absolutely immersive experience, but as a strategic studies nerd, a compelling insight into the dynamics of asymmetric warfare. I was reminded at times watching it of the classic film Lawrence of Arabia, and I couldn't help but see in the Fremen avatars or exemplars of the asymmetric actors that have characterised our very own international system. But that's just the nerd part of me. Apart from that, it was just a great film. How about yourself, Darren?
I actually saw it a few nights ago and it was an utterly exhilarating experience. I have not been that pumped up walking out of a cinema in over 20 years. So my highest recommendation as well. I want to recommend a recent episode of one of my favorite podcasts, The Ezra Klein Show, as I've recommended many times before. But on this recent interview, he speaks with the author Mary Lynn Robinson, who has just written or released a new book called Reading Genesis. And by the Genesis, we mean the book of Genesis in the Old Testament. I've never considered myself an especially religious person, but I do find religion fascinating, both through the lens of spirituality and mysticism, but also as an institution that helps organize human behavior. I'm sure that would resonate with you too, Andrew. And the great religions offer guides on how to live life, what it means to live a good life. And that guidance may come from God, but it also is quite practical and does, I think, help solve cooperation problems, as I spoke about earlier in today's episode, like the prisoner's dilemma, which many listeners will have heard of, where there are two parties who can achieve so much more together than they can apart if they can find a way to trust each other and work together. And one of Robinson's main arguments is that the book of Genesis is actually very much a story of forgiveness. Now, there are moral and spiritual reasons why forgiveness is a positive, virtuous thing, but there's also some pretty solid social science that tells us that being forgiving, at least on occasion, is actually really important in solving cooperation problems over generations, right, over many, many iterations, and that actually occasionally being forgiving can help build trust over time. And indeed, societies that can incorporate forms of forgiveness into their culture, into their practice, tend to survive longer. The logic of punishment, of an eye for an eye, actually has its limits. And I'm sure, Andrew, you're thinking of the same works that I am from the 1980s by Robert Axelrod and Robert Cohan. And so thus, it was interesting to me to hear an interpretation that the very first book of the Old Testament, which is supposed to be about and is about creation, might also be about forgiveness, and which is, of course, as those familiar with the Christian tradition will know, is a core theme of the New Testament and the story of Jesus Christ. And so hearing this now and speaking to you all now in 2024, I would observe that there are many ways in which forgiveness might have an important role to play in solving some of the most intractable problems that we face as a race. And it's notable to think that texts which have their origins thousands of years ago might, quite apart from their spiritual elements, offer a guide. And I'm reminded, Andrew, of you talking about the antecedents of the Good Friday Accords or the Camp David Accords. You know,
we have these answers written down in many ways, decades, if not millennia, back in time. And this was a really beautiful and warm discussion, which does veer into discussions of the current conflict in Gaza as well, but with that anchor of a deeply important cultural and religious text as a guide. And so it was, I found, very worthwhile.
That sounds absolutely fascinating, Darren. You're taking me back to my Anglican upbringing, but I think that you're also demonstrating a new side of yourself as potentially a powerful religious as well as intellectual leader. You could indeed be the Muad'Dib of ANU.
Well, on that somewhat questionable note, Andrew, this has been a real pleasure. I've really enjoyed digging into these issues. We've been going for a long time, but look, hey, that's what was needed. And I'm grateful to those of you in the audience who are still with us. These questions require, as I've said many times before, careful analysis and depth and time to work through. Andrew, it's been genuinely really interesting, engaging, and pleasurable to do this with you. And I hope that we can do it again sometime in the future. Thank you.
Thank you, Darren. I very much hope to be back. And it's been an absolute delight talking with you today. Thank you.
That's all for this episode of Australia in the World. For research and audio editing, I thank Corbin Duncan and, of course, Rory Stenning for composing our theme music. That's all, and we'll talk to you again soon.